This week in The Function Room, Census Sensibility, a glimpse into the work of Ireland's Central Statistics Office, the CSO, with statistician Jess Coyne. Yes, it's been a while since the last one. There was the Easter break and a bit of childminding and whatnot intervened, so I took a count, and it turned out from the data there weren't enough hours in the day. I'm back now, and this time we're talking about what questions you ask and how you ask them to get the numbers that represent what's going on in a whole country.
My name is Jessica Coyne, a statistician. I work for the Central Statistics Office. I'm based below in their head office in Cork. I work in the Social Data Design and Innovation Department, more specifically in the Questionnaire Design Unit. So I help design and implement questionnaires based on national and international requirements to produce data on certain topics.
How did you get into that?
I have a bit of an unconventional route into the Central Statistics Office. My background is actually in agriculture, studying animal science, a master's that took me into quantitative genetics, to a PhD again in the area of quantitative statistics.
Yeah. What's quantitative genetics? What do you...
What I looked at was the relationship between the physical expression of a genetic component of an animal. So looking at our physical characteristics are made up of genetics and the environment in which we're brought up in. And part of my studies was looking at that relationship for specific physical characteristics in specific animals. So from my master's, I looked at dairy cows and like their physical characteristics, which are called type traits. So their stature, shoulder height, shoulder width, depth of an animal. And then for my PhD, it was more in the line of pigs. So I changed species, looking at pigs and a different aspect. So how fast they grow, their fat composition in their meat when they grow, how feeding them can enhance their genetics to grow bigger and faster and tastier.
Okay.
So,
all right. Okay.
There's a huge, and that's only one tiny, tiny, tiny aspect of like quantitative genetics. It spreads the whole way through to the human genome and obviously just the genome of all species.
Okay. So anyway, I interrupt you. Sorry. So you were cows, then pigs.
Did a couple of postdoctoral research. An opportunity arose one day to apply for the CSO run, I suppose at this stage you could say nearly yearly competitions. I'm looking for statisticians to join in August 2019. I started here and I haven't looked back.
And probably not why you joined it, but the CSO, they count cattle and pigs as well, don't they? I mean,
yeah.
They don't go into the genes of them, but every year there's a cow, pig and sheep census, isn't there? And goats.
Yeah, we do. There's a whole division and a whole agricultural division that looks after that here. The CSO is quite an interesting organization. It covers a huge number of divisions. People most associate the CSO with the census. That's probably our most recognized component, but we've loads of different divisions, like we just mentioned there, agriculture, business statistics, balance of payments, national accounts, they all come under our remit. So it's actually a huge, huge organization with loads of different facets in it. But funnily enough, I came from an agricultural background, but I actually didn't go into the agricultural division. I went into social data collection. I suppose from my studies, the skills that I picked up, the analytical skills and also the communication skills and the writing skills that I had picked up over the course of my studies. They're quite applicable across different disciplines. So there was the position that I was put in was in the questionnaire design unit in social statistics. And that's where I've been since.
When you're designing a questionnaire, is there maths involved in the questions or is it the social side? When in the phrase social science, what bit is the, if I ask that question, I'll get that answer and that will lead to different numbers. Like, do you kind of sit around going, well, that question doesn't give us bang for our buck, or how does it work? Because it feels like a real interesting mix of mathematics and psychology and design, and even, you know, what size font to use and how many pages to have. It's a real mix.
It is. It is huge. And you've just mentioned a couple of the different kind of areas that you have to be, you know, flexible to work in. So I suppose the first thing is it depends on what we're trying to capture. So we have a lot of surveys in social statistics that are regulatory surveys that come from Eurostat. So we're bound to produce these statistics and return them to Eurostat. They would come with very strict regulations as to what, first of all, we're to collect. So even though we're a questionnaire design unit, we actually don't deal in questions when we're dealing with our customers. So we provide a service. So what we look for are variables, and what variables are is the actual data point that you want to collect. So an example of a variable would be if you want to collect age, sex, employment status, education level of individuals or the population as a whole. These are what we call variables. So we get this, what we expect then from our customers is they give us these list of variables. It's very straightforward for the regulatory surveys because they're bound by regulation. And even from Eurostat, we get suggested answers or questions rather that we should use and answer categories that reflect what we need to return back to them. So some of those are quite straightforward, but extremely technical. And a lot of like the methodological work behind those surveys has been done prior to us receiving them. And so a lot of the kind of graft work has been done at a higher level and then just kind of disseminated out to the countries to collect that information. If we have, we'll say, a national customer come to us, so maybe somebody has realized that we're missing information on a certain element of society, or a certain story or anecdotal story that's coming in on society, and they're like, is this actually the truth? Well, what do we need hard facts to see exactly what's going on out there. And like,
and
that
will that sometimes, you know, with that anecdotal thing, will that be like literally, you know, friend of mine is saying that you know, he applied for this and that, and then nobody, you know, nobody got back to him. That's why nobody's applying for this particular thing. And in fact, it's not true at all. It's just one or two people had an issue. Is it kind of differentiating fact from anecdote? Is it?
Yeah, that's kind of it. So I suppose, like, yeah, in order to get a true reflection on what's happening in society, we need cold, hard facts or numbers to tell us, literally counting what's going on out there. So so I'll take, we have a national module coming up now in quarter three and quarter four of this year around equality and non-discrimination. So, you know, we know that discrimination goes on. There's lots of anecdotal evidence out there. There's lots of cold hard evidence out there. You see it coming from, you know, reports and through the media and stuff, but we still need to go out and interview people to find out exactly what they have experienced. So we need to get the full picture. So not only do we need to talk to the people who have experienced, we'll say I'm using discrimination as an example. We need to speak to people who have experienced discrimination. And also we need to speak to people who have not experienced it. So like I said, we get the full picture of what's happening at a countrywide level. So in various, in cases like that, then when our customers come to us, and the customer can be anyone, we've had loads of customers over the years. I mean, the National Transport Authority, there's loads of different, not just governmental departments, but loads of other areas that would come to us, because I suppose they know that collecting information and providing, like, we're the National Statistics or the NSO for Ireland, they know that it's our bread and butter. We know how to go about doing it.
When you go out asking the questions, people will trust you that they, you know, you're not just somebody ringing them up out of the blue.
Absolutely. And it's one of like the core pillars, obviously, that the CSO trades on, you know, is trust, confidentiality. You know, people trust us to interact with us, tell us their story, give us their data. They trust us to look at it, to collect it, to process it in an ethical and a confidential and an anonymous way, and produce national statistics that we need in order for people to make informed decisions. And it's a really, there's a very high level of trust in the CSO, And that's obviously reflected.
So let's say you have a national customer has asked you, stuff is bubbling up. It could be in the area of discrimination or some other series of anecdotes have come up and saying, is this as big a problem, or is it just the people that have experienced it have talked a lot about it? So when you sit down then to work out the survey, mm-hmm. How do you know how many people to ask? How do you know how big the sample size is? I know you're probably going to get, it probably gets a bit technical. Is there a high level kind of thing where they're saying we need to ask 1,000 people based on the size of the population or the question we're asking? How does it work?
Yeah, where to start? So this is, the customer will come to us. They say, right, this is the information that we need. Okay, and we'll sit down with them and we'll talk down through them. I suppose this is kind of like an overview now of a life cycle of a survey like that. So we'll interact with the customers. We'll ask them, you know, first of all, we'd sit down with them. We're like, right, okay, what's there at the moment? What are you using? What are you referring to? How long has it been since you've collected or you've had this information collected? So we know what sort of like time or what sort of gap we're bridging with the new information that's coming in. And we'll ask them exactly what it is that they want to know, basically. And I know that's like, you're kind of sitting there in front of me being like, that's such a, maybe a bit of a silly question. They've come to you, they know what they want to collect, but it's not sometimes until you sit down with a customer that they realize that what they actually want to collect and what they're asking us to do are two completely different things. And that's, it kind of comes full circle back to, that's why we would deal with these variables, that the points that you want to publish on, as opposed to coming to us with questions that you think are going to produce that information that you need. So then when we've settled on what they want to collect, and it can range from a short survey. Now you wouldn't see too many of these because when surveys, people get the opportunity to produce a survey, they think that everything needs to go into it and that they'll never get this opportunity again. And the kitchen sink has to be in there. And I suppose that's part of our job as well with liaising with the stakeholders, that we kind of get them to kind of reassess just exactly what is very important and what they actually need versus what they want as such. So when we've settled on what they want, and like I said, a short survey could be 10, 15, 20 questions, right up to some of our regulatory surveys, you know, would be quite large. Then we would liaise with our methodological department. So I think I mentioned that the CSO is actually like quite a large organization with lots of different divisions. And we have a specific methodology department that would deal with that question around, well, how many people do we need to sample? What sort of a response rate we need in order to meet the precision that will allow us publish this data as national statistics, that they will stand up as statistically sound data. So we have a full department of statisticians that look after that whole section for something like the national customers or the national needs. Like I mentioned, the regulatory surveys that do come into us do have a huge amount of that work done, and our methodological department would just kind of check over it, I suppose, and maybe, you know, we would liaise with them a small bit if we thought we could make any tweaks or changes or anything needed to be required. So once we've kind of gotten the okay from the methodology department and gotten those figures around like precisions and what we need to calculate, the response rates that we need to get back and ergo the sample that we need to distribute, we have another division.
So, and just to interrupt in the methodology, so they will take the English language that you send into them saying we need to collect these 8, 10, 6, however many things from this population of people, and they sort of plug that into formulae, statistical theory, and it sort of spits out in order to be like 95% confident this information is correct or to have this margin for error, you need to ask X number of thousand people and 60% of them need to respond. That stuff is almost like stored in tables or in formulae or in complicated maths.
Yeah, that's it. And like that's what a method pathology department is there for, so they would help us, you know, with the sample size, as you mentioned, the sample size, the design, you know, how we're going to sample the population. So we always sample the population. So for social surveys, there's sample surveys, because obviously we are not the census at the end of the day, so we can't go around and knock on every door. So what we do is we have a sampling unit then that obviously does the random samples, so that we get the best coverage of and variation within the people that we're going to speak to. Because obviously, if we just sample one area or one age group or one education level, we're not going to get a true picture of what exactly is happening out there. So any of our sample surveys, and that's generally all of our social surveys that we do, it has to be representative of the population as a whole. So each survey that we do, then one person that sampled in a survey represents a certain number of people. Yeah. Now that's specific to each survey. So like our labor force survey, one person in that would represent X number of people. In our survey on income and living conditions, our SILC survey, again, it would be a different ratio. One person sampled in that would represent Y number of households in the country. So
to randomly sample, I know I always use the word random wrongly, because I know it has a very specific it has mathematical meaning. Yeah. But let's say you need 1,000 people, for argument's sake, to answer a question, and there are 2 million potential people. Let's say it's some sort of survey of workers or some description, as opposed to maybe a more niche group. Mm-hmm. The sprinkling of that 1,000 amongst the 2 million, is that a computer program takes a crawl through a phone book, or what goes into the black box of sampling then? Is that a separate department?
I don't mean to be shying away from it, but it is a separate department. We have a sampling unit that looks after this, because obviously we have a huge amount of surveys going on at this, not only in social statistics but also in like business statistics and other areas. So like, that's why we have all of these divisions with all of these statisticians in there that work on the specifics. So the sampling, I actually spoke to one of the members of the sampling unit, Aoife O'Neill, and Aoife was explaining the random sample. Now, we didn't get into what's inside in her black box, but yeah, it is a program that she runs. She explained that, you know, basically it gives us a better selection of a respondent, so there's more variation. So as I explained, you know, that it's not all middle-aged females of a certain education level that we're picking, that we have to have that spread all around the country. And a lot of it is, so she would run the sampling program, and then they would use a software called ArcGIS to map those distributions, is what we call them. And that's because we have a field force. We have, I think we're up to about 120 field interviewers that are out knocking on doors every single day, bar Sundays, but every day of the week, trying to get people to engage and to respond to our surveys. So this ArcGIS system helps the sampling and distribution team map the most optimal route for our interviewers to contact all these houses in a timely manner. So it's
kind
quite
a traveling salesman problem is rolled in there, and everything to minimize kilometers.
And try to optimize, you know, our interviewers. Like there's 120 of them out there. They have a lot of surveys to, you know, a lot of doors to knock on every week, never mind every quarter. And I suppose it's to help them manage their routes so that they get around to trying to at least touch base with these people and encourage them to participate with us and interact with us in a timely manner. So that is built into our sampling and our distribution unit. So it's there's a huge amount. I know sometimes you mightn't think it, but there's just so many elements to getting a survey out there, to getting somebody to, thankfully, when one of our interviewers knocks on the door and someone says, "Yeah, I will participate," there is a volume of work and considerations that have gone in by the time we get there. So that's just one element of it, you know.
So the probability, so two probabilities: one, that they'll get to the door in time, to have optimized their distance traveled to get to the number of doors, and then that the door they knock on, A, is useful, and B, the person will say yes.
Yeah.
Like that, all those percentages, because everything, I suppose, is a percentage likelihood that somebody will actually answer the door and not be like going, oh, look, I've just put the baby down for a nap. Yeah. I can't answer right now. So all of that, you're trying to reduce the amount of time that your 120 people are wasting, you know, in order to get as much bang for their buck as possible. So all that is optimized by programs that spit out routes and addresses.
Yeah, specifically this ArcGIS software, and we have a team of people in here that are work on that specifically as well. I can't express just how many people are involved in this. So many different everyone. My job has an effect on the next person's job, the next person. So it's one big, massive operation, and like every cog has to fit in perfectly. And like it culminates then with our field force. They're obviously the face of the organization. They are going out, knocking on the doors, trying to, you know, encourage the general public who have been randomly selected, you know, how important it is. It's almost like, I know people don't think of it as being this way, but inside the office we do. If you have been selected like that in a sample survey, it's like winning the lotto, you know? I mean, you're talking about the same, you know, like it's sheer random luck. Yeah. Well, I know people won't see it as being a positive thing sometimes, but it is. It's like being drawn for the lotto. So you've been randomly selected to participate, and like, it's really important.
Yeah, but
that
so
you
you're...
take,
if not the national lottery, certainly it's a 1 in 1,500 chance, maybe, or 1 in 2,000 chance that your house has been selected.
Oh, yeah. Well, even larger than that. Yeah, larger than that for some of our surveys. So our labor force survey and our survey on income and living conditions, they have much larger samples than that. Thousands upon thousands. Yeah.
So with all that, I kind of don't really realize that the amount of mathematics and modeling that goes into that knock on the door. And then do you feedback if somebody, like in all the no's and yeses, so regardless of the actual answers to the questions, does all the field team then feedback, well, I not, you know, these are the rejection, these are the people who didn't answer, and here's why? And does that go back into the model then to kind of update it to say, that house is no point in calling there because they all say no? Or how does it work?
Yeah, it does. So that information is fed back into us, absolutely, into the office. So our interviewers are provided with the hardware they need, phones and tablets to go out to the door, and they try and engage with the person. Now, it's not cold calling as such. I suppose to give the full picture of it, they would have received a letter from us inviting them to take part and letting them know that our interviewer is going to be in their area, and that, you know, if they would like to call the interviewer directly to make an appointment to when it suits them best to participate, then they're the contact details. So they're not just turning up on somebody's door cold. First of all, I'm talking a lot about it, but the actual thought and the processes that go in to it, into that lead up to them, you know, knocking on the door and hopefully getting some face-to-face interaction with the potential respondent is massive. So then when they're there, like you said, what we're always hoping for is that the respondent is like, yeah, I have just put the baby down for a nap and I have half an hour and I will absolutely give you our time and, you know, help you out in the best way we can. And our interviewers are unbelievably skilled at once they get to talk to a respondent and they get to impress upon them how important it is and how lucky their household is, been selected. It's representing a household, you know, this many other households have a similar structure, similar, you know, loads of different attributes of that household. You're representing, you know, groups based on, you know, certain demographic information on your household. If they, and equally, so that's obviously the best case scenario when they call and they get to speak to someone and they take part there and then. But like you just mentioned, we have a setup where if they call to the house and there's nobody there, or they can't contact them, or they have to make an appointment to call back at another time, all of that information is collected electronically in their tablets, and it's referred back into the office. And then inside in the office, we have a field administration unit, and they like correlate or amalgamate all of that information. And we make certain decisions on certain what we call outcomes for our interviewers. So if they are constantly calling to a household and they just cannot seem to catch anyone at the household, well, then it's put into a pot of, well, maybe we should write to these people again and just try and explain to them how important they are and that we need their information. So it's not necessarily fed back into the mathematics of the sampling and the distributions. It's fed back in and it goes into another cycle inside here of how to try and engage with that person, because every single respondent that is sampled is really important, and we do want to give them every opportunity to take part. You know,
you're in this unique position of actually looking at society from a view that few people get. Are we all the same? when we all think we're all unique, in the world of statistics, when you sample people, does it turn out that, let's say you pick 1,000 people as a sample for a particular group.
Yeah.
Does that mean that there are 1,000 types of people and that most people fall into a certain number of categories statistically? You know what I mean? Like, even though we all think we're unique, but actually we're all the same. Do you get that view from looking at society over the course of, I suppose, what is it now? You're 5 years in the job and you see the results. Do people average out? Like, is there a law of large numbers that says that actually large groups of people sort of behave the same in different countries?
From the data coming in, like, we're really lucky. So I know you're talking about like individuals and, you know, how they perform in their group or their majorities or minorities or that. And I suppose for us, we kind of look at it slightly differently, in the sense that we look at, like, as opposed to looking at the individuals, we look at kind of trends that these cohorts of individuals are going through or producing over time. So like when we look at the data, we look for trends emerging across like different areas. So a lot of so I work on the data collection side, and we also have another side that is results and publication. And they're the people that analyze all the data and produce the lovely publications that we hear about and see in the media and on our website at certain points throughout the year. So these the statisticians on that side, they cross-tabulate the data to see as many insights as possible. And generally they do that by like employment. We take an example of like employment, and they'd look at that across age, region, population, sex. And like, so as opposed to looking at the individuals, we look at the trends of the sampled population as a whole, we'll say. So it's really interesting. And like I said, like I mentioned, I know it's slightly before I start, but like that EU at 50 project that was completed here last year, like having collected information back in the 1970s, particularly around 1973, which this figure is from, seeing the trend of the reduction of people working in agriculture. So in 1973, there was 24% of the Irish, 24% of people in Ireland worked in the agricultural section. And in 2022, when we looked at that same figure, that 50 years later, almost 50 years later, it had dropped down to 4%. So when we collect data, they're the trends that we look for, not so much as, you know, where that individual has gone between 1973 to 2022 or 2023, just to see like the trend in a specific sector or a specific topic, like employment or you know, education or lifestyle, you know, or wealth. So they're the kind of trends that we look at, and obviously they are extremely interesting. And and also, it's not just us that get to look at them. We have all of this information, and it's disseminated in our publications throughout the year, and also all available on our website. The CSO website is fantastic, and been able to look at the data and the tables and the publications from the tables from the publications that have been released. It's all up there, and it's really, really interesting. We've been able to do some quite clever things over the last, obviously with technology and time and getting data together and getting shapes on different things. We've been able to put some really cool interactive tools on our website as well. There's a men and women hub, so you can go in and you can look at, like, you know, what men are doing, men of a certain age, men of a certain education. You know, you can have a look at the trends that are occurring for men and women. We obviously have our baby names. There's an interactive tool on the website as well. So all of that information is really interesting. So we don't just collect the data, hold on to it and look at it and see all the really interesting things ourselves. We put it out there for everyone to have access to it and have a look at it, and hopefully in an easy enough form that people can kind of navigate around it as well. So
I wonder, and what are men doing apart from all hosting their own podcast?
What are they at, like?
can you actually see the men are from Mars, women are from Venus statistically in your survey?
I mean, like I said, we look at across all of those different types of kind of what we call that socio-demographic information. So information around your age, your sex, the region where you live, your education level. So our statisticians, they're generally what the results would be published across, so people can get a good insight into, you know, what's happening in real life for specific groups of people. So that's where I come back to it, just about the individuals. We don't focus on the individual as such. We focus on the group. So it's not Jess Coyne, you know, at, you know, number one Main Street, County Cork. It's the female that's in the 35 to 40 age bracket with this level of education, with this household structure. That's what we're interested in, and that's where we look at the trends across those data, or across collecting information. That's the story that we want to find out what's happening. That's the story that we try and tell, you know.
Coming up in part two, why it matters how you ask the questions. There's obviously a development of technology and all of that, but does the fact that you have field workers going out interviewing people, does your maths and your model assume that there's a human interaction in the gathering of data? Because do people answer a question differently to a person standing in front of them holding a tablet rather than online? And is there an error there that has to be corrected for, if there are not an error, but a difference between the mode in which you answer the question, whether it's to a human or to a machine?
I suppose that's a good area to touch on, and it's a huge area, I suppose, that comes in under our remit in questionnaire design as well, is around the mode. So the mode being how we're going to collect the data. So typically a lot of our information prior to COVID was collected via what we call CAPI interviews, which are computer assisted personal interviews. And they're our interviewers going out, knocking on the door, tablet in hand, asking you the question and you verbalizing an answer, or offering you answer categories, you picking an answer category and then recording it. Another way that we did collect information, and I'm saying this is just predominantly now prior to COVID, and I'll explain why, because it was a fast track there as COVID brought a large a number of areas of life. And then we also used computer assisted telephone interviewing, CATI. So we'd have contact numbers. Generally, these were for longitudinal surveys where we go back to the respondent on a number of occasions over a certain period of time. So like our labor force survey would be a longitudinal survey, our survey in income and living conditions, that would be a longitudinal survey as well. Again, looking for trends in our data that we collect. And so some of those longitudinal surveys would have been done over the phone. So we'd have a contact number and they'd ring back. An interviewer in a call center, that we have a call center, would ask the question, offer the answer categories, and the person would answer. And then COVID hit. And obviously, even just prior to COVID, like, there was obviously foresight in the sense that, you know, things were going to have changed, like society was changing, people were becoming more technical, technology was becoming a bigger part of our life. It always is. And like, we knew that we were going to have to, you know, embrace it from a data collection perspective as well, and offer, like, people had less time to talk to us, people had less time to talk to our interviewers, you know, people's time was becoming way more valuable because they had an awful lot less of it. So we knew we were going to have to adapt and make changes as to how we collected data. And then COVID hit. So it fast-tracked all of our development around computer-assisted web interviewing, or CAWI interviews is what we call, where it's almost a self-completion. So somebody agrees that they'll participate in our survey and they'll do it themselves via a very secure link that they receive in an email with the PIN and a username and a PIN. Or whatever way we want to set it up, and return their information to us in that way. So COVID obviously accelerated the kind of the development around that. And it also changed the way we kind of thought about offering and designing and developing surveys, right? So to come to the kind of mode effect that you're talking about then. So mode effect, what we've seen, so in the questionnaire design unit, like, we're really lucky that one of the areas that we have that we have expertise in is in cognitive interviewing questions. So basically what that is where we would test questions to make sure that different people that we ask this question, that we're asking the same thing, people interpret the question the exact same way, the answer categories are fit for purpose, that the language that we use is understandable by everyone. We've quite a low national average literacy in Ireland, and we're always very mindful of that when we are producing questionnaires to gather, you know, statistical information. We still need to be able to communicate with the people that we want the information from. COVID helped us kind of fast track that, and we were able to look at, like, providing different modes depending on the type of questions we're asking. Because you're right, a lot of the time we ask sensitive questions, but, like, sensitivity, it's a very subjective thing. So I might ask you a question around your income or your pension, and you might find it extremely sensitive and don't want to engage with the questions because I'm asking it. But if it was presented to you online in a survey, you might have absolutely no problem whatsoever in answering it. And equally, something that you find not sensitive, I might find very sensitive. So these are all of the elements from questionnaire design that we have to try and take into consideration. And that's where it comes down then to choosing your mode. We've run a couple of surveys where we have implemented the CAWI mode, the computer assisted web interviewing, which is essentially self-completion based on the fact that the questions that we're asking are of quite a sensitive nature. And they've been very successful. As a result, for the future, all of our surveys are produced across all the modes. So your computer assisted personal interviewing, which is your interviewer going out, your CATI interview, which is over the telephone, and then your CAWI version as well. And the idea behind it is people have less time. In order to make it easier for them to interact with us, we put the respondent at the center of all of our design, and we see how can we make it as easy as possible for the respondent to give us the information that we badly need from them to tell this picture of what's happening in Ireland on a daily basis or a weekly basis or a monthly basis. How can we make it as easy as possible for them and also our interviewers to give us that information?
And when it comes to the results then, have you ever done a survey where you've just, you know, possibly even in the questions, made assumptions about a particular area of society, and then society has just completely surprised you with the answer, and at the end of it you went, I thought I knew. Ireland, does a population move quickly in any areas in your experience? And by move, I mean change, as opposed to travel around.
This is a tough one because obviously we're all human beings and we all have assumptions about various elements. But when it actually comes to a project and collecting data inside here, we cannot and we don't deal in assumptions or anything like that. Our sole purpose in here is to go out and ask questions about what's happening in real life and gather that black and white data, those figures, and bring them in. So yeah, obviously on a personal level, there's probably things that I saw, I was like, oh, that's kind of peculiar, I didn't realize it. But it's not our job to kind of, you know, we put aside all those assumptions or misconceptions when we're starting a project. We collect the data and you know, I suppose the data tells its own story, you know. Yeah. It tells us exactly what's happening. And like I've kind of mentioned throughout, like we do look for these trends, and a lot of our regulatory surveys would have this almost built into them, where we would have so modules or certain groups of questions that would be asked in specific years or with a specific periodicity. So they might be asked once every 6 years. So, but it's been once every 6 years for the last, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. Then we can look back and see that over the course of 50 years, this is how society has changed. And we know this is factual because we've gone out, we've asked them the series of questions. And again, it's not the individual, it's the female in this age bracket with this education level. We've kind of monitored what they've been doing over the last 30 years, having a look at the trends.
I know it's not the area that you're working in. Just out of curiosity, in the census, at what point do you go, right, I think we have everyone. We don't have the last X number of thousand, but it's good enough. Like when it comes to something like a census.
Probably our best known division, because everyone knows about the census because it happens and, you know, everyone gets involved and it's a big publicity run into it and all that. I think the coverage for our last census from 2022 was 96%, which is very good. You know, obviously everyone strives to achieve 100%.
So 96% of the forms you sent out, you got back in. Is that right?
Out of 100 forms that we sent out, we got 96 back.
Yeah. And then within the 100, would you say that 100 represents all the possible ones? Or would you say that probably there might be, that it might be that actually the true potential number of forms to sell out might be 100.3, if you know what I mean, like, because some people you just can't reach, you know what I mean, or you don't know.
There are people that we can't reach. And in fairness, like, geez, the census they put in a huge amount of work, and we're trying to engage in the kind of hard to reach people and community. So, like, I suppose gated communities, they're very hard to contact and speak to. They do outreach programs with minority groups to try and get them to engage. And, you know, they do a huge amount to try and get everyone involved and get everyone to participate. But as a whole, with the coverage of 96%, we're left with a 4% deficit to 100. And that 4% is supplemented by administrative data that we have access to and can use for statistical purposes. Through the Statistics Act, we have the power to, I suppose, access data from loads of government departments. So I suppose the really important thing to remember with that, I suppose, comes a huge responsibility. And like the CSO is able to accept all of this data, and because of our Statistics Act that we operate under, we can use this data for statistical purposes. But equally, we never, ever, ever share that data that we receive with anyone else. So when we get it from other government departments or other areas, that we have the power to use it for statistical purposes. And that's what we do. And that's what we do with the administrative data. We use it to supplement, to enrich the, so like we've two types of data collection. We have primary data collection and secondary. And the primary is literally going out and knocking on doors and asking people questions and collecting primary information that way. And then the secondary data collection is this administrative data that we use to enrich the primary data sets, you know? So
after all the censuses and all that kind of thing, there's a very, very low chance that at some point in 10 years' time, somebody will go, where does all the people come from? You know, like, because because of the different ways of counting.
And just to give you one small bit of extra information on that, we actually have another area. You're going to wonder how we managed to fit the CSO in Cork with the number of divisions I'm telling you about. But we have another area that looks at the population projections. And there's a huge, now that this is quite technical, they use a lot of modeling around that, and they use loads of different data sources, obviously the census stuff, but they do a lot of modeling around the population projections and stuff like that. So it is another area that's constantly been worked on. We've statisticians doing that, and they quite an interesting but very technical.
So they will look at the 65 questions answered on the form, and they look at number of children or households and all that kind of, and where people are living and where they might go to. So that must be fascinating, because they're trying to predict.
Yeah.
They're trying to hand information to a government planning for, well, you hope there's a government planning for 20 years' time.
They're planning for something, yeah.
Yeah, like how many are there, where the schools need to be, how many hospitals we'll need, all that kind of thing. And that's all contained in the answers to your questions.
Yeah, like that. I mean, we need, so like with anything, like you need a base and you need a really good foundation to start from, particularly when it comes to modeling data. You know, I mean, your model is only going to be as good as your inputs, you know, the information that you feed your model. If you give it bad information, it's not going to perform at its optimum, whereas if you can give it lots of information, lots of variables, and you feed it into your model or your equation, then obviously it'll perform, and you remove remove as much variation as possible, so you get a better you get better reported outcomes. But yeah, so we have an area that looks at population projections. So like that, just modeling the populations. I suppose inward and outward migration, stuff like that, you know. Really interesting area, and another area contained within the CSO organization.
CSO umbrella. And then is it a fun job to do? Like, do you find out about humans through counting them? Do humans surprise you?
People surprise, they do. Is it a fun job to work in? It's so interesting. You know, I mean, there's no day that's in social statistics anyway, there's no day that's the same. You know, you're working with the same surveys. The topics within the survey change. So you work with loads of different surveys. OK, you have your regulatory surveys that come from Eurostat, and they're fairly standard. But at the same time, there's still variation in there where they change. Like I mentioned, those modules for looking at trends over time. So like some questions will go in every 6 years, some will go in every 3 years, some will go in every second year, some will go in and even years and out and odd years, and vice versa. And even depending on the wave that the person is interviewed. So remember I said the longitudinals, that we go back to the person at a point in time over a certain period of time. They're called waves. So even the wave that the person is interviewed on, you know, there can be a variation in what they're being asked. So in social statistics, it's really dynamic. It's always really busy. You don't know who you could be working with. I mean, I'm only here 5 years, and I've worked with such a variety of different external customers as well as internal customers. So it's really, really interesting. And I, like you said there, do people surprise you? People do, because I suppose inside in the office, and particularly in my area, we do a huge amount of testing. We test everything. We test questions. We test questionnaires. We test how they operate. We test how it looks on a tablet. We test. We try and test everything, but at the same time, we're doing it inside in almost like sterile conditions. And it's not until you go out to the general public, or not us, but like our field staff, we hand it over. We're like, yeah, brilliant. 10 out of 10. Everything's working off, you know, best of luck, lads. See what you can do. And it's not until they go out into the real world and they come across a scenario and you're like, I never tested for that, because I genuinely didn't think that scenario existed out there. Yeah, so then it goes on the list. So like, do people surprise me? They do in the situations that our field staff come across or, you know, encounter. And yeah, it's a really interesting job.
There's a tendency to think, you know, we're all just a cog in a wheel, and we're all just one number. But given that you do longitudinal studies, there must be individuals who you sort of statistically now know very well. Would that be right? People that you've studied over a number of over a period of time. Is there within statistics like a representative person who has represented their group over a period of time? So in some ways, the story of their life has been told, albeit masked behind stats.
I suppose it's, again, not so much the individual itself. So the individual we'd have an interaction with, so we'll say for the Labour Force Survey, the LFS, it's 5 quarters that they're interviewed. So they would be, if they're interviewed in the first week of January, or the first week of quarter one of the year, it'll be the first week of quarter two, the first week of quarter three, quarter four, quarter five. And that's actually really, really important because there's very strict reference periods for some of our regulatory surveys. So we have to interview that person, or that household rather, it's not necessarily the person. We have to interview that household at a very specific point in time. So our interviewers, yeah, they would build up a relationship with the household when they're going back for those longitudinal surveys. And that's so important for us. The interviewer is so important for us when it comes to longitudinals like that. First of all, to get the person to engage, even for the standalone surveys, right? But to get the respondent, the randomly sampled respondent to engage and participate and then agree to stay. And then the silk is a good bit longer. Interviewers could be calling back to house over a 4 or 5 year period. And they build up such relationships with people. So yeah, they would have that kind of interaction with the household or an individual, if it's a single person household or whatever. But for us, from a data perspective, again, it comes back to this household representing a certain cohort of people, and it's, I suppose, those cohorts that we can identify with or in the data and that we look at in the data to see, well, how are you doing? We had one really interesting module in our survey on income and living conditions last year, and it was like transgenerational advantages and disadvantages with housing. So basically over, this was asked every 6 years, so we could see how the advantages and disadvantages of housing had moved with cohorts of people over the last number of years. Our interviewers would have that interaction with an individual or a household, and they'd build up that relationship and they'd see how those people progress over a certain period of time. But for us inside here, when the data gets to us, it's completely anonymized. We need a name and an address to identify a location for our interviewers to knock on a door. And once they've found the dwelling, after that, the identifiable information around, you know, the name and the address is no longer required, because we don't look at individuals. We look at data aggregated together as a whole.
And just to finish up, what's next? What will you be working on over the next 5 years? Or how do you see it changing in the next while, counting people's all their vagaries and their... Yeah. Their madness and badness and goodness and all sorts.
We have seen dropping response rates. Now, not just Ireland, this is across internationally. You know, response rates have been dropping to surveys. Probably Ireland, we're probably lucky in the sense that it hasn't been at such a rate that some other countries have seen. But I suppose that's going to be a huge challenge from a data collection, from a primary data collection source, from primary data collection. So for the likes of our area and social statistics. So I suppose it's trying to work and develop new processes, new ways of collecting information, new procedures, like anything we can do to contact people and engage with people and get them to participate in our surveys. That's a lot of work will be focused on that and developing other kind of avenues for data collection, I suppose, over the next couple of years. You never know what's coming around the bend. Like, I mean, prior to COVID coming along, we thought we had a timetable as well, and then COVID hit and then everything got thrown in the air, and you know, different projects are prioritized. So it's quite a dynamic area. And one of our main focuses is going to be on trying to tackle the kind of falling response rates and seeing if the administrative data center, looking at how they can use administrative data to the best of the ability. I suppose the CSO is, you know, venturing into that area of kind of data stewardship and stuff where it comes to administrative data, and I suppose putting that to the best use possible and putting in the structures for it to work as seamlessly as possible.
Mm. You mentioned COVID.
Oh, yeah.
In some ways, a multi-year societal situation forced upon us that was a fundamental change in how we move and work and travel.
Yeah.
Are you still churning through the data from that? What does COVID look like in your stats? Is it a blip? Is it an interruption? Is it an inflection point? Do you know yet what COVID and lockdowns and has done to society? Or is that something that will take a while?
That's a really good question. From the data perspective, I'm not 100% sure, because we have our results and publication statisticians, and they look at that, they analyze the data that we get in. From a data collection perspective, I suppose COVID has seen a bit of a shift in how we work slightly, in the sense that prior to COVID, what our interviewers found like the best time to get in contact with people and get them to interact with surveys was at night, because obviously they're away in the office working all day, every day during the week, Monday to Friday. So calling in the evenings kind of, you know, was the best time to get in contact with people. Whereas that has shifted, and we can see that because obviously people now have hybrid working and people can work from home. And they're there to answer their door if someone knocks at 12 o'clock in the day, when that was just not even a possibility prior to COVID, you know, unless obviously it was a person who was a stay at home or stayed at home. That was their job or whatever. But so little things like that for us, we've seen those sorts of changes that they're the kind of changes that have been forced upon us for COVID. And we'll say the likes of our field staff and that. And that we've had to adapt to.
Yeah.
I mentioned as well, like the fact that nowadays people, their time is very precious and they have less of it. I don't know what COVID did, how it sapped time away from us, but people just seem to have less and less time. So I suppose we've had to kind of alter what we do to try and change our designs and our surveys so that we put the respondent at the center of our design and try and make it as easy and as quickly as possible for them to give us the information that we need, you know? But from the data perspective, you know, like you said there, is it a blip? Like, all I can say is that we maintained data collection over the COVID period. Our interviewers obviously couldn't go out knocking doors anymore, but they did have contact numbers and they were able to write to people and ask them to ring them to participate.
It isn't until a number of years after COVID that you can see trajectories until you know whether the years of COVID had a different slope or whatever. Interesting stats to come out, presumably, in the next few years in a retrospective look, maybe at the 2020s as a whole, to see what they what those couple of years looked like.
Yeah, it is going to be interesting to look back on it from an Irish point of view, but it'll also be interesting from, like, those regulatory surveys that we get from Eurostat. They're rolled out in all of the other member states in Eurostat as well. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out, like you said, in maybe a number of years' time, where did they look back at that data at that time period in different countries. And I suppose it would be interesting to see what happened. Like, because those regulatory surveys, they're the exact same in each of the member states. And obviously they have the same reference periods and stuff, so they'd be collected at the same time. So it would be very interesting maybe to see, you know, if they looked at it at a country versus country basis, you know, how things developed or adapted over that period of time, you know.
Dr. Jess Coyne, thank you so much for coming into the Function Room.
Thank you so much for having me, Colm.
That was Jess Coyne there of the Central Statistics Office. That's it for the Function Room for this week. So, Like, subscribe, review, follow. Get in contact at hello@colinmorrigan.com if you have an idea for a topic or a guest, or just to say hello. Goodbye.